welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back, and it's now or never, and we have Paul Venable with us. And Paul, I owe you an apology. I had no idea how close we were to ending our, we would have been able to just kind of close off with a couple of comments on the first citation that you read. And so forgive me, please.
Time flies when you're actively engaged.
That's so correct. So you were reading a really powerful, so I just want to dive straight into this. You were reading a really powerful commentary by Mr. Pendleton. Now, Mr. Pendleton is a name that we're going to see every once in a while, but he's not a dominating force, but he dominates now, and then he'll dominate towards the end as well. And so he is actually one of those that actually brings up the, this frustration that they have with the fact that the anti-federalists keep on trying to grind this axe that the delegates in the convention, the Constitutional Convention, exceeded their commission. And so, you know, I believe he's going to be one of those that says, hey, enough. You know, we already settled this kind of thing. So anyway,
okay,
go ahead and start it from the top again.
Here we go. But it is represented to be a consolidated government, annihilating that of the states, a consolidated government which so extensive a territory as the United States cannot admit of without terminating in despotism. If this be such a government, I will confess with my worthy friend that it is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole and exclusive power, legislative, executive, and judicial, without any limitation. Is this such a government? Or can it be changed to such a one? It only extends to the general purposes of the Union. It does not intermeddle with the local, particular affairs of the states. Can Congress legislate for the state of Virginia? Can they make a law altering the form of transferring a property or the rule of dissents in Virginia? In one word, can they make a single law for the individual, exclusive purpose of any one state? It is the interest of the federal to preserve the state governments. Upon the latter, the existence of the former depends. The Senate derives its existence immediately from the state legislatures, and the representatives and president are elected under their direction and control. They also preserve order among the citizens of their respective states. And without order and peace, no society can possibly exist, unless, therefore, there be state legislatures to continue the existence of Congress and preserve order and peace among the inhabitants. This general government, which gentlemen suppose will annihilate the state governments, must itself be destroyed. When, therefore, the federal government is, in so many respects, so absolutely dependent on the state governments, I wonder how any gentleman reflecting on the subject could have conceived an idea of a possibility of the former destroying the latter. But the power of laying direct taxes is objected to. Government must be supported. This cannot be done without a revenue. If a sufficient revenue be not otherwise raised, recurrence must be had to direct taxation. Gentlemen admit this, but insist on the property of first applying to the state legislatures. Let us consider the consequence that would result from this. In the first place, time would be lost by it. Congress would make requisitions in December. Our legislature do not meet till October. Here would be a considerable loss of time, admitting the requisitions to be fully complied with. But suppose the requisitions to be refused, would it not be dangerous to send a collector to collect the congressional taxes after the state legislature had absolutely refused to comply with the demands of Congress? Would not resistance to collectors be the probable consequence? Would not this resistance terminate in confusion and a dissolution of the Union? The concurrent power of two different bodies laying direct taxes is objected to. These taxes are for two different purposes and cannot interfere with one another. I can see no danger resulting from this, and we must suppose that a very small sum, more than the impost, would be sufficient. But the representation is supposed to be too small. I confess, I think with the gentleman who opened the debate, Mr. Nicholas, on this subject, I think he gave a very satisfactory answer to this objection when he observed that though the number might be sufficient to convey information of necessary local interest to a state legislature, yet it was, did I read that right? Though the number might be insufficient to convey information of necessary local interest to the state legislature, yet it was sufficient for the federal legislature, who are to act only on general subjects in which this state is concerned in common with other.
Yes, in which.
With others. The apportionment of representatives and taxation by the same scale is just. It removes the objection that while Virginia paid 1/6 part of the expense of the Union, she had no more weight in public councils than Delaware, which paid but a very small portion. By this just apportionment, she is put on a footing with the small states. In point of representation and influence in councils, I cannot imagine a more judicious principle than is here fixed by the Constitution. The number shall not exceed one for every 30,000. But it is objected that the number may be less. If Virginia sends in that proportion, I ask, where is the power in Congress to reject them? States might be inclined to send too many. They are therefore restrained. But can it be doubted that they will send the number they are entitled to? We may be therefore sure from this principle unequivocally fixed in the Constitution that the number of our representatives will be in proportion to the increase or decrease of our population. I can truly say that I am of no party, nor actuated by any influence, but the true interest and real happiness of those whom I represent and my age and situation, I trust, will sufficiently demonstrate the truth of this assertion. I cannot conclude without adding that I am perfectly satisfied with this part of the system.
So there you go. Any comments, any questions, any concerns?
You know, there was so much covered. I'm not going to admit to anything at this point. I'll tell you in the next several of these, and this is Virginia, and there will be many. I'm going to stop where I have a question. Okay, I've done that before. I just didn't do it this time.
Okay, so
you might want to up, but I there's a lot of information here.
Yeah. So no. One of the things that to me really jumps out is the apportionment and representation. And the reason this is going to be so important, folks, because look, how would the states react if the federal government said, look, we're not getting the right amount of political power out of every person? If they actually said, we believe that this is a sacred maxim, that one person, one vote, that we need to equalize the power of the vote, which is not constitutional. It's not an inalienable right, nor is it anywhere in, from the Declaration into our Constitution. This is something that has been injected by the democratic, or I should say the communist movement of creating a democracy out of America. So where would the states be if all of a sudden the Supreme Court, you applied this principle on apportionment and actually wiped out the boundaries of all of the states for congressional representation, that the people of different states, such as North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, would share one representative?
Right.
How would
get this, that representatives would traverse state boundaries like they do in counties.
Correct. Correct. Well, that's what I'm talking about, where you'd have one representative that represented like multiple counties in one state or multiple states in the House of Representatives. That this yeah. is a perversion, because clearly the interest of one state, I mean, the reason one state formed, why did South Dakota and North Dakota split? Because they felt that their interests were that significant that they were requesting to split. They were already the state of Dakota, right? So when you look at the Enabling Act, the state of Dakota had already been admitted to the union. And so now the state of Dakota was seeking a ability to split. So when you read the Enabling Act, they really go through, you know, hey, you know, you need to have the people vote in a very specific manner, and, you know, how to do it in both, you know, the North and South. And if the people actually vote for splitting, then this is what you have to do. And, you know, there's nowhere in the Constitution, by the way, for a state to actually split where it goes to the people. Does that make sense? In other words, the state legislature has to decide that, you know, we feel that, and then they apply to say we want to basically create a divided state. We want to divide our state. Right? When you look at what it takes for division of a state, it doesn't require the vote of the people. Does it? Paul, I'm not hearing.
I was on mute.
Okay.
Ask me the question again, because I had an interruption.
Okay, so there's a process. There is a process in the Constitution for states to split. And so what is that process if the states are to split? Are the people to actually choose whether they want to be split or not? Or is it left to the legislature to determine that splitting would be the best thing to do?
The Congress says the legislature.
The Constitution says that, yes, as well as if it affects the board boundary of another state, then the legislature of those states, you know, should also pipe into it as well.
Right, the legislatures of both states or all the states that are involved. Right.
So actually, this is a great cause to let's pull up Article 4 then. And so as I'm going to my handy dandy color coded Constitution, and it'll pull me to Article 4, Section 3. And it's the last part. The Congress shall have the power. It's the first part. But no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the jurisdiction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well. Okay, so right. It all states that are being split. I thought that the boundary states would have, you know, a say in it, but I was wrong. I was injecting that. So, okay. So in this particular case, why did the Enabling Act put it upon the people to choose whether the state of Dakota should split or not?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Because this just goes to show how Congress was overreaching and actually creating a condition that should never have happened. The state legislatures had already expressed this, so why in their Enabling Act did they take it to the people? Because the Constitution states that it's by the state legislatures to be done.
So what you're saying is North and South Congress unconstitutionally required a process of splitting North and South Dakota, correct?
Correct. In splitting the state of Dakota into two, they wanted the people to actually, you know, vote for that splitting instead of allowing the legislature to say, yes, we want to split.
Okay. Is that what actually happened? Did the people actually do that, or did the legislatures do it? because I don't know the history.
So it's in the Enabling Act. The Enabling Act had a convention, and they had to vote for. And so it was actually in that each state actually had to have, a majority vote for splitting the state. Yeah, right. So when you read it, you go, oh, my gosh. I mean, they really went sideways on this.
Yeah.
So anyway, anywho, I just thought it was an interesting point to bring up. But as we look at this whole concept of dividing states and the, smearing boundaries, that flies in the face of our Republican form of government. It just flies in the right. face of this. And so how is it that Reynolds v. Sims and Baker v. Carr was, not challenged with any, vigor at all by the counties and the people of the counties? What the heck happened?
Well, that's a surprise to me. And let me share something with you really, really quickly. This brought up a question. So I was pretty actively engaged in when we were in Idaho, and I'd go to the State House often, and what it has pictures of the legislature from the 60s to the present. And I noticed something, that the legislators before 1963 were all by county.
Yep.
And then after 63 or 64, they were by legislative district. So I knew there was a change. And Jer, until I ran into you and I asked about it, and no one had an answer until I ran into you, I had not heard of Reynolds v. Sims.
Right. But see, I didn't know. Why is it that there was no huge resistance to this? Why?
I could, you tell me, because I don't know. It looked like, here's what happened. The Supreme Court said, and everyone's been conditioned to believe that the Supreme Court is right about everything.
Right. I can buy into that. I also believe that at this point in time, with the beginning of the counterculture revolution starting in the late 50s, where democracy and anarchy was starting to take to the streets of America. And so everybody by this point in time, really started saying, hey, we've got a democracy. We've got a democracy. Right?
And that's the... The continued clarion call. I hear democracy almost every day, almost every public office, almost every media person. It's almost like they're trying to drill democracy, and they have.
Yes.
Drill right. democracy into people.
Right. So I think they believe that they had basically indoctrinated enough of America to buy into this. It's only been through, the very few that stand up against, these assertions of democracy. No, we're supposed to have a Republican form of government. Then somebody would, okay, placate. Okay, yeah, you're right. But it doesn't mean that we don't have a democratic form of our process. And that's how they sidestep it. And then next thing you know, nobody really gets and understands this Republican form of government, which is how this goes back to our yesterday conversation with the General Assembly and the Sovereign Citizen Movement. These people who claim to be conservative, are buying into this democratic anarchal form of, challenge, this paradigm of challenging this. And again, it is not our government. These are the illegitimate powers and vestiges that have attached themselves to our government by those servants who are violating their oath of office to allow these things to exist. Anyway, so, I mean, yeah. When you step into office, if you don't challenge everything and say, how is all of this stuff constitutional? Then that's that you can't ever get to the bottom. When you walk in and you just accept government as it is because that's how it's been, then you become a part of the problem. So anyway, the next one is by Governor Randolph, and this is there's two little notes under here, and we've got paper money that is brought up first. And so this is important because, as you know, the digital currency and this whole, you know, currency fiasco we're facing as a nation, what he has to say, I think, is kind of important of why, you know, money and currency was very, very important to the framers, especially in this Constitution. So do you have that? You ready to go?
I have it, and I'm ready. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, go ahead. Yep, go ahead.
There is a, I hope you don't hear it, but there's a lawnmower in the background.
No, my neighbors. I don't hear it. I don't hear it.
Great. Okay. I have before hinted at some other causes of quarrel between the other states and us, particularly the hatred that would be generated by commercial competitions. I will only add on that subject that controversies may arise concerning the fisheries, which may terminate in wars. Paper money may also be an additional source of disputes. Rhode Island has been in one continued train of opposition to national duties and integrity. They have defrauded their creditors by their paper money. Other states have also had emissions of paper money to the ruin of credit and commerce. May not Virginia at a future day also recur to the same expedient? Has Virginia no affection for paper money or disposition to violate contracts? I fear she is as fond of these measures as most other states in the Union. The inhabitants of the adjacent states would be affected by the depreciation of paper money, which would assuredly produce a dispute with those states. This danger is taken away by the present Constitution as it provides, quote, that no state shall emit bills of credit, end quote.
Okay, so in other words, the paper money that they're talking about here is clearly identified as a threat that depreciates the value of property. And bottom line, he even points out that no state shall emit bills of credit. So when the federal government a long, long time ago started issuing paper as a representative of a silver coin and a gold coin, then you would have the ability to commute that paper or basically go down and transfer or exchange your paper for coin. And then you could go home with your coin and you could save your coins, you know, instead of leaving them in the bank. So what was the enticement? What was the enticement of being able to keep your money in a bank? Well, actually, if you understand, you know, inflation and everything else, putting your money in a bank really wouldn't have done anything as long as it was paper money. Right? Because over time, as paper money inflates and as the based on the current coin and the paper money, what ends up happening if your currency inflates? In other words, they have more coins in circulation, then you start losing the value of your coin, right? That happens with anything. It's like if I have an abundance of tomatoes, the price of tomatoes goes down. The value, of tomatoes actually goes down. If there's only, you know, one tomato available in the nation for the year, then that tomato is going to seize a very handsome sum. Does that make sense?
Right.
Okay, sure, okay. So that's the same thing. So banks had to create this thing called interest to, you know, make it, I'll just say, appealing for anybody. So we're going into break right here. So anyway, so the whole point of interest was to get people to leave and rest your money with the bank so that you would make money while you allow them to use your money as collateral to invest in other things. And banks started beginning to operate under the principle that only 20% would be held. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so my point in going into the break is that banks needed to, so they needed you to deposit money, and so they had to lure you with these guaranteed interest rates. And for the longest time, banks actually maintained an interest rate. Why is it that banks today either don't pay interest or they don't do that at all? Why is that?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I remember our parents, when we were kids, promoting savings accounts for each of us because there was an interest rate.
That's right.
You know, I wonder now why people even bother to use a bank, except, you know, for the security of not having all of their money in their house. There's another thing that comes to mind, and about my parents who grew up in the Depression, and their parents, is that they were savers. And I think we had kind of a savings economy back then, not a credit economy. And so people, they didn't trust banks, and especially after the Roosevelt administration. You know, when the government confiscated their gold and forced them to take this paper. And right. So that's I don't know if that's an aside, but that these things come to mind when we bring up this subject.
Well, so the reason why, and if you notice, I don't know if you had an account, but I had an account when I was a young man. And the interest really started floundering after Nixon took us off the exchanging of gold from paper to gold and paper to coin. And so when he took us off that exchangeability, you know, so that we could commute our paper to coin and so forth, then that's when the value of money and the concept of, you know, banking would actually pay. Because bottom line, after that happened, guess what happened? The federal government started throwing money into banks. That's what they do today. When they print money, it goes straight into banks.
So, by the way, did Nixon have the authority to do that?
No, he did not. He had no authority to do that.
So what happened is, here's what happens. Congress does things without authority. President does things without authority, but then people act on it as if it's true.
Well, so Congress wouldn't have had the authority to do it either. It would have required an amendment to the Constitution to getting off the gold standard. So the reason why the president did it is because he claimed an emergency measure. The reason why Nixon did it at that point in time was because the price fixing, the oil embargo and the fixing of prices on, you know, food like poultry, eggs, you know, those types of things, Nixon seized full control. Congress gave him full control over the economy and with his executive orders. This was all done unconstitutionally. With his executive orders, he usurped the Constitution, or just like Wilson and FDR. We had presidents right. that exerted a power, an unconstitutional power, and did things that absolutely set us up. You know, and I wonder, were these men, so this is the question that you really have to ponder. Did these men really understand what they were doing, the damage that they were doing, or did they really believe that what they were doing was, you know, something for the better? And I have to think that they had to have understood that they knew they were violating the law, and that bottom line, whatever good that they were bringing out of it was not for the good of the people. It was never done by, you know, so I can't believe that these people really felt that, you know, the American people were going to benefit from our actions. It had more right. to do with we were going to gain more control over the American people each time.
I think that you do.
So anyways, now the next one is kind of just a note when we're looking at the next comment from Governor Randolph. It's a little bit further down. And so it. Go ahead.
I am afraid I have tired the patience of this house. I think he meant tried the patience. But I trust you will pardon me, as I was urged by the importunity of the gentleman in calling for the reasons of laying the groundwork of this plan. It is objected by the honorable gentleman over the way, Mr. George Mason, that a Republican government is impracticable in an extensive territory, and the extent of the United States is urged as a reason for the rejection of this Constitution.
So let me pause right here, and you may want to fix your headset and or your microphone. And while you're doing that, I want to actually clarify something here. This is another exertion by the Montesquieu's doctrine that a Republican form of government can only be applied at a small level. Now, and actually he cites Montesquieu as Paul will continue. But what we're going to find out is that this government that we have, folks, is a multi-tiered Republican form of government. At the smallest level is where the government, the true richness of a Republican form of government is to be actualized. And what is that smallest tier? That is your county. Now, when we look at the states, even the states were too large of a sphere of a Republican form of government. But that's when the states would actually assume a role of a general government in making sure that the county's interests throughout the state are being protected. And then at the next level up, as we basically create a state of states, then now we have a third tier where even less power is delegated. So each time we step up to, you know, the next level, to the state level, powers are, you know, restrained, or the state should not have all the powers that the county has. And the federal government should not have the powers that the states have, which is why they're not consolidated governments, and they're not truly, at the national level, it is not truly the Republican form of government that Montesquieu is talking about that has all of the powers of the people. Does that make sense? Paul, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can okay. you hear me now?
I can't hear you now, yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay. So you left off that a gentleman over the way, Mr. George Mason, that a Republican form of government is impracticable in an extensive territory, and the extent of the United States is urged as a reason for the rejection of this Constitution.
So here's a question I had. Is Mr. Randolph referring to George Mason as having said this?
Yes. And then it goes on. This is what he says. Go ahead.
Because I'm just wondering if this is the same George Mason who's who's considered the father of the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
It's okay.
The very right. same. So Colonel Mason, they call him Colonel Mason in here, and George Mason. Go ahead.
Okay. Let us consider the definition of a Republican government as laid down by a man who is highly esteemed. Montesquieu, so celebrated among politicians, says that, quote, a Republican government is that in which the body or only a part of the people is possessed of the supreme power, a monarchical, that in which a single person governs by fixed and established laws, a despotic government, that in which a single person without law and without rule directs everything by his own will and caprice, end quote. This author has not distinguished a Republican government from a monarchy by the extent of its boundaries, but by the nature of its principles. He, in another place, contradistinguishes it as a government of laws in opposition to others, which he denominates a government of men. The empire, or government of laws, according to that phrase, is that in which the laws are made with the free will of the people. Hence, then, if laws be made by the assent of the people, the government may be deemed free. When laws are made with integrity and executed with wisdom, the question is whether a great extent of country will tend to abridge the liberty of the people. If defensive force be necessary in proportion to the extent of country, I conceive that in a judiciously constructed government, be the country ever so extensive, its inhabitants will be proportionably numerous and able to defend it. Extent of country, in my conception, ought to be no bar to the adoption of a good government. No extent on earth seems to be too great, provided the laws be wisely made and executed. The principles of representation and responsibility may pervade a large as well as small territory, and tyranny is as easily introduced into a small as into a large district. If it be answered that some of the most illustrious and distinguished authors are of a contrary opinion, I reply, that authority has no weight with me till I am convinced that not the dignity of names, but the force of reasoning gains my assent.
Okay. go ahead.
So it sounds like what the argument here is that, you know, the country may become so big that it would be unmanageable. And I think that's what he's addressing here. That,
yes,
that the arrangement, and I think he does a good job of talking about how a Republican form of government can work from the small level to a higher level over an extended period of space.
Yep. But okay. So on top of that, though, see, at the county level, at the, because this is why I kept on emphasizing county, state, federal. At the county level, where you have the ideal Republican form of government, where, you know, everybody kind of knows each other and there's, you know, we know who the scoundrels are. We know who, you know, have committed crimes, you know, but when somebody, you know, walks into a brand new community, the beautiful thing about this free country is you can run from your reputation. And, okay. And so, I mean, this is how people would, you know, get away with serial crimes, is they would pull it off in one spot, then they'd go somewhere else and pull it off because they would become trusted, then they'd steal, and then they'd go somewhere else and become trusted and steal again, and how a life of crime, you know, could easily be extended instead of, you know, because that's the beautiful thing about this huge nation. However, the beautiful thing for criminals to be able to do those things, because when people, you know, live in a community, they don't make a living out of going from one community to the next, to the next, to the next, unless they're, you know, using this facade of this being unknown and not having a reputation. See, you know, we actually became more and more disjointed and more, you know, wanderers, or I should say, we started traveling a lot more and conducting business at a grander scale or broader scale. But bottom line, we still had roots in our community. But the whole point of this small power is where, you know, you now have at the county level, you should have all the power to determine whether you're going to have a healthcare system or not. And the best government is the government that has the least amount of ability to corrupt itself by using money to provide services to people. The more government has the access to money to provide services, the more corrupt government becomes. And so maintaining, you know, a separation of government from these community services, this is why churches were so successful in bringing forth education, bringing forth healthcare, bringing forth, you know, job placements and those types of things, because they're suited for compassionate services and they're not profit-based. So there was, you know, far less corruption. Every time when you look at these state universities, they, you know, they become profit-based. They need more money. They need more money. They keep on, you know, wanting more. Now, back in those days, churches were very, very limited. They weren't profit-based in the beginning. It wasn't until the evangelical movement where all of a sudden Christianity and the Christian church became profit-based. Because this is when people actually started making a living, you know, off of, you know, teaching or preaching the word of God. But anyway, so back to this whole scaling, you know, at a county level, that is the perfect form of where you have the majority of your political energy. At the state level, it's limited. So if you have an insurrection, you have a sheriff who has the militia or a posse and is able to deploy the posse to basically suppress the insurrection, or an invasion if your county's on the border or something like that. And if your sheriff doesn't have enough resources, he can quickly appeal to the state, and the state can marshal their forces to your vicinity to help you. If at the state level they don't have enough resources to the magnitude of the invasion, then they can call upon the federal government to bring more forces in. This is the beauty of this system. And see, Montesquieu did not understand a multi-tiered republican form of government. He was looking as a single government. The complexity of this escapes Montesquieu completely, but people kept on thinking that this was a single-tiered government, that it was consolidated, and it wasn't. Which is why they kept going. They kept on making these points that, hey, you know, the federal government only has these powers. The states have all the rest of them.
Okay, now I must have missed this point about Montesquieu. Is it the anti-federalists that are quoting or resting on Montesquieu for their arguments?
Yes, they are.
Okay,
because Mason, you got to remember, George Mason is the anti-federalist. But he was a good anti-federalist that really wasn't trying to protect the cabal. He was an ideologue. See, you had two types of anti-federalists. Well, actually, you had probably three. You had ideologues like George Mason, who really wanted the purest of the government to be the best it possibly could be. And then you had these people that didn't understand much, but they had a lot of respect for these other anti-federalists. So they got sucked up into, you know, I respect these guys, so I'm supporting them. Then you had this other third element of the anti-federalists, like Henry, who was really all about protecting the power that they have built in their state, this cabal of power. They did not want to surrender any power whatsoever to the federal government.
Okay.
And so I'll remind you, if we go back to Massachusetts, remember there were a gentleman or two that were anti-federalists that said, hey, look, you know, we don't need this Constitution. We can actually stand as a separate sovereign state. Go ahead and dissolve the Union. We're fine without that. And so there you go. I mean, you can actually see how these people really didn't care for, you know, this perpetual union.
Wow. Okay. All right. So we are we in encroachments now?
So we're on Madison's note. That's the first one, which is Madison's note. Madison then arose. Oh. Yes, right.
Okay, yeah, I saw a note for Randolph, and I thought, I'm in the...
Yeah, okay. So actually, when you look at this, this is June 6th, and this is a very long oration by Madison, and we're only bringing up highlights of these different orations that he's going to give here. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, let me go back to it. I shall not attempt to make impressions by any ardent professions of zeal for the public welfare. We know the principles of every man will and ought to be judged not by his professions and declarations, but by his conduct. By that criterion, I mean in common with every other member to be judged. And should it prove unfavorable to my reputation, yet it is a criterion from which I will be by no means depart. Comparisons have been made between the friends of this Constitution and those who oppose it, although I disapprove of such comparisons. I trust that, in point of truth, honor, candor, and rectitude of motives, the friends of this system here and in the other states are not inferior to its opponents. But professions of attachment to the public good and comparisons of parties ought not to govern or influence us now. We ought, sir. Can I stop here for a minute?
Sure.
It's that he is, when he is, it appears that he's trying to keep the debate within a certain area.
Uh-huh.
And when he says comparisons, it seems like he's addressing an issue of how people or some of the delegates are referring to each other. Am I reading that right?
Yes, correct. Now, they made an agreement of how they were going to conduct these debates, that they were going to stick to line by line. They would debate it and move forward. They wouldn't go back and forth, leap forward and so forth. And once they agreed that they were going to methodically go through the Constitution, it was completely abandoned by the Anti-Federalists. In other words, the Anti-Federalists that kept on getting up. So the question is, and at this point in time, you know, most people thought that they were kind of even, but it was the hardcore cabal protectors that were those who were, you know, not following the rules. There were still Anti-Federalists that were still trying to follow the rules. Like James Monroe was an Anti-Federalist that converted during the debates. And you can see where he talks about he has an Anti-Federalist paradigm. And then next thing you know, down the row here, as we go through these debates, you'll actually find where James Monroe actually says, I'm in favor of this Constitution now.
Okay.
So in other words, he's no longer speaking out against it. He's finding that these things actually, you know, support why we need to ratify this. So, okay, go ahead.
Okay.
And so the reason this is important is because I want people to understand the lack of, I don't want to say civility, but, you know, those who are the opposers of this Constitution were resorting to tactics and stepping outside of the agreed upon rules. They were rule breakers. They were cheaters. They were liars.
And it appears to me that Madison is trying to address this issue.
Yep. Yes, he is. Yep.
All right. I trust that in point of truth, honor, candor, and rectitude of motives, the friends of this system here and in other states are not inferior to its opponents, but professions of attachment to the public good and comparisons of parties ought not to govern or influence us now. We ought, sir, to examine the Constitution on its own merits solely. We are to inquire whether it will promote the public happiness. Its aptitude to produce this desirable object ought to be the exclusive subject of our present researches. In this pursuit, we ought not to address our arguments to the feelings and passions, but to those understandings and judgments which were selected by the people of this country to decide this great question by a common rational investigation. I hope that gentlemen, in displaying their abilities on this occasion, instead of giving opinions and making assertions, will condescend to prove and demonstrate by a fair and regular discussion. It gives me pain to hear gentlemen continually distorting the natural constructions of language, for it is sufficient if any human production can stand a fair discussion. Before I proceed to make some additions to the reasons which have been adduced by my honorable friend over the way, I must take the liberty to make some observations on what was said by another gentleman, Mr. Henry. He told us that this Constitution ought to be rejected because it endangered the public liberty, in his opinion, in many instances. Give me leave to make one answer to that observation. Let the dangers which this system is supposed to be replete with be clearly pointed out. If any dangerous and unnecessary powers be given to the general legislature, let them be plainly demonstrated. And let us not rest satisfied with general assertions of danger without examination. If powers be necessary, apparent danger is not a sufficient reason against conceding them. He has suggested that licentiousness has seldom produced the loss of liberty, but that the tyranny of rulers like almost always has almost always affected it. Okay, this is, and let me go quick to encroachments because I just looked at the clock and I don't know how many minutes we have left.
Right, we got, okay, so we got 2 minutes left to.
Oh, good.
Okay, so okay. Go ahead.
Since the general civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. But on a candid examination of history, we shall find that turbulence, violence, and abuse of power by the majority trampling on the rights of minority have produced factions and commotions which in republics have more frequently than any other cause produced despotism. If we go over the whole history of ancient and modern republics, we shall find their destruction to have generally resulted from those causes. Madison was very aware of history.
Yes.
And I wonder if what he's saying in this area of encroachments, literally that you pulled this out because it was almost a visionary. Okay.
Right.
That he's seeing what's happening to us today, except that I don't think it's the majority right now that are trampling on the rights of the minority. Well, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is.
How we're using a democracy, that's actually what's happening.
Yes, correct. And which is mob rule or majority rule. And so This is where the beauty of our system, here's my complaint with every state. Every state in the union uses mob rule for its amendment process instead of actually clearly delineating a majority of counties, not a majority of the vote. In other words, if every state realigned its constitution to say, you know, we cannot amend the constitution without a majority of those states. So, Paul, let's pick this back up in our next episode. I really apologize. We always run out of time, but that's what happens when you span so much, you know, in these ratification debates throughout this time. We can't do this in one show. It requires a series of shows. And so, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.